Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Hello, a very warm welcome to Spotlight on Europe. I'm Zipporah Nyambura in Bonn, Germany. Coming up in the next half hour, Germany prepares to repel Russian hackers as elections approach.
Some analysts think Russia could already have sensitive information about Merkel, her peers, or secret government policy that could sway voters away from traditional parties.
Disappearances in Turkey raise fears that the country is heading for darker days. Brazilian player Neymar completes his €222 million transfer to Paris Saint-Germain. But is any footballer worth that kind of money? Stick around for these stories and more in this edition of Spotlight on Europe. This week, we have been talking about hacking in the Kenyan elections. The opposition claims the electoral system was hacked by the government to favour the incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta. Fears of election hacking have spread across Europe as well. Germany's intelligence agencies are convinced that Russia will attempt to influence the country's federal election at the end of next month, just as they did in the United States and France. Political parties have been warned to be vigilant in case of hacking attempts. Officials have stepped up the monitoring of fake news on social media. Nick Martin has more on the struggle to keep the Kremlin out of German politics.
Germany's domestic security agency warned in May that it had foiled repeated email phishing attacks aimed at Merkel's ruling Christian Democrats as well as other parties. It warned that Russia and possibly other state actors could be attempting new cyber attacks on political leaders and government agencies. If successful, it would not be the first time that Germany's lower house of parliament, the Bundestag, was hacked, says political scientist Dr. Andreas Heidemann-Gruder.
Since 2009, several attacks on government servers were undertaken by the Russian government, including hacking most of the computers in the German parliament, but also of certain special committees, for example, the NSA special committee in the Bundestag. Its documents were leaked to WikiLeaks, and our intelligence community assumes that the Russian government stood behind that.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's ambition to weaken Washington's global influence is well documented. Allegations of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin are currently the subject of several US investigations. Meanwhile, France has accused Russia of launching a similar campaign of influence to disrupt its presidential election at a critical time when many people were threatening to vote for the far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. Some analysts think Russia could already have sensitive information about Merkel, her peers, or secret government policy that could sway voters away from traditional parties in Germany's September 24th poll. While Merkel is currently way ahead of her main rival Martin Schulz of the Social Democrats in the polls, her mandate could be severely weakened by any major embarrassment. Laura Daniels, the German Chancellor Fellow at the Global Public Policy Institute in Berlin, thinks that by targeting Germany, Moscow may be attempting to send a message to Brussels too.
Russia and Putin has made very clear that he would strategically prefer a weaker European Union. Breaking it up to him, he perceives it as strategically beneficial to him. So if he can weaken Germany and thereby weaken European solidarity, either through Merkel or through casting doubt on the German government as it stands, then that would probably be to their advantage.
Whether revelations come from the successful hacking of government servers or from the spreading of fake news, anyone attempting to influence the German election has plenty of possible avenues. For one, there's the migrant crisis and attempts by Merkel's government to assimilate more than a million asylum seekers into German society.
Im Fall eines vorübergehend verschwundenen deutsch-russischen Mädchens in Berlin ist nach Justizangaben aufgeklärt.
Last year, the case of a 13-year-old Russian-German girl who accused migrants of kidnapping and raping her caused a diplomatic spat between Berlin and Moscow. That is, until it was revealed that she'd made up the story.
Heute telefonierten die beiden Außenminister Lavrov und Steinmeier miteinander.
Fears about Islamist terrorism and the threat to the German economy from the Dieselgate scandal could also be manipulated to influence voters. But researchers at Britain's Oxford University, who have been studying the rise of automated social media accounts to spread political disinformation, say they've yet to uncover any serious attempt by Moscow to try and swing the German election. Lisa Marie Neudert is part of the university's computational propaganda project.
We didn't find any smoking guns. We didn't find anything that points directly to Russia, other than a couple of Russian media outlets that are also vocal and that people seem to like. But other than that, no red flags.
But she warned that although Twitter isn't as popular in Germany as it is in the US, Facebook and messaging apps could help spread fake news instantly, something that was revealed following a recent terror attack in southern Germany.
When we're looking into the shooting that happened in Munich, false information that was spread there, that was mainly spread over WhatsApp, and that happened in only the matter of hours. So messaging services and Facebook are very efficient at spreading messages too, and it doesn't have to be Twitter.
The German government has spent most of this year tightening security protocols and helping political parties to protect their sensitive data. While they may be able to reduce the chance of fake news or a major cyber attack in the last few weeks of campaigning, state actors like Russia and Turkey, who has its own beef with Germany's leaders, don't necessarily need to spread disinformation. Dr. Andreas Heinemann-Gruder from the University of Bonn thinks the Kremlin, through its media outlets Russia Today and Sputnik News, merely need to discredit genuine news stories from respectable sources. He highlighted a Human Rights Watch report earlier this year on chemical attacks by the Syrian government that was disputed by Moscow.
In the meantime, the whole story is no longer sold because everybody begins to question. So there's constant diffusion of information, this disinformation, this undermining credibility of sources has a certain effect, because you think then, you know, all the media are lying. I don't know who is lying. So in the end, it is not that you make an alternative statement. It is simply a constant confusion of the minds.
Perhaps more importantly, Germany's multi-party electoral system makes it less vulnerable to outside influence than the US and French elections, where two candidates were vying for position. With Merkel likely to need a second or third party to achieve her fourth term, any attempt to weaken her own party wouldn't necessarily strengthen just one of her rivals. Instead, support could be spread among them all. The magazine Foreign Policy reported last week that with the element of surprise now missing, an increasingly sceptical German public and a less sensationalist media, any attempt by the Kremlin to impact next month's vote is doomed to fail. Nick Martin, DW, Bonn.
Human Rights Watch says government clampdowns in East Africa on peaceful protests and free expression severely threatened human rights last year. In Ethiopia, state security forces suppressed widespread protests against government policies, killing hundreds of people and detaining tens of thousands, similar to what is happening in Turkey since last year's failed coup. Over 60,000 people are in jail and more than 100,000 have lost their jobs under emergency rule introduced after the botched military takeover. Human rights groups are voicing alarm at what they see as worrying new development, disappearances. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the abductions are reopening memories of one of Turkey's darkest chapters.
The US-based Human Rights Watch has sent a letter to Turkey's Justice Minister, Abdulhamid Gül, calling for an urgent investigation into the disappearances of at least four men in the capital, Ankara, over the past few months. The organisation's senior Turkey researcher, Emma Sinclair Webb, says there is worrying indifference by the authorities.
At the moment, there hasn't been an effective investigation as far as we can tell, but there is lots to investigate. The cases we've looked at were people who were abducted in broad daylight in Ankara streets in front of witnesses, and these witnesses have given testimony. We know what vehicles they were taken away in terms of the make of vehicle, the Volkswagen transporter vehicle. We've got security camera footage showing those vehicles. In one recent case, a case in June, a man was abducted in front of his 8-year-old son, as well as in front of local shopkeepers. And there is no excuse not to investigate it.
One of the disappeared is Mustafa Özman, a trained lawyer and university lecturer. His wife, Emine, is sitting with her young children and is visibly traumatized by Mustafa's abduction. She says her desperate efforts to find out what happened to her husband have been met with silence.
My husband didn't come back home after dropping off our eldest daughter at school on Tuesday, May 9th. The next day I went to the police and other places to ask for information, but I didn't get an answer. We have three daughters, 4 months old, 5 and 9 years old, and they ask every day where their father is. I can't answer them. Please, help us.
That silence is fueling growing suspicion by human rights groups of state collusion in these disappearances, a charge denied by the authorities. But one of the abducted turned up after 42 days in police custody, claiming he had been tortured and interrogated during his abduction. And all those abducted had been purged from their jobs, accused of being followers of the US-based cleric Fethullah Gulen, who the government accuses of being behind last year's failed coup. Sinclair Webb from Human Rights Watch acknowledges that the numbers of abductions is relatively few, at most around a dozen. But she says they evoke memories of Turkey's recent dark past.
We've seen that Turkey has, unfortunately, a very notorious past in which people were disappeared by the state, and they were mainly Kurds, and it happened in the 90s. And we don't want to see a return to that pattern. So it's very important that the government act now to stamp out this practice.
During the 1990s, when the Turkish state waged a war against the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, hundreds of activists and civilians disappeared at the hands of the security forces. Most turned up dead on the streets several months later or eventually found in mass graves. Ironically, when President Erdogan was prime minister, he had been in the forefront of stamping out torture and bringing those accused of being behind the disappearances to justice. Those groundbreaking measures were praised by human rights groups, although only two people were convicted out of the hundreds of cases. But now human rights defenders are themselves being arrested in the ongoing crackdown. Andrew Gardner, the Turkey researcher of Amnesty International, says these latest disappearances are a sign that investigating human rights abuses is becoming increasingly dangerous.
None of us have security in Turkey. These activities which we undertake on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, if all of this is criminalised, then next week it could be me who's imprisoned, it could be someone from Human Rights Watch, it could be someone from the National Human Rights Associations.
In the 90s, many of those abducted were last seen being dragged into white Renaults. The car became synonymous with one of Turkey's darkest chapters. The fear today is that the country could be sliding back to those days, and that black Volkswagen Transit vans have replaced the white Renaults. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
French football club Paris Saint-Germain, or PSG, has just signed the most expensive player to date. That player is Brazilian Neymar da Silva Santos Jr., who transferred from Spanish club Barcelona for €222 million. But the extraordinary sums don't stop there. That record-breaking pot of gold was just to buy Neymar out of his so-called no-buyout clause. Estimates of the actual cost of the whole deal, including Neymar's salary, taxes and fees to his advisors, his charity and his agent, his father, bring the whole lot of over 5 years to between 700 and 800 million euros. Chuck Penfold is from the Deutsche Welle's sports department. My colleague Emma Wallis asked him if anyone was worth that kind of money.
That's a difficult question to ask. You know, it reminds me almost of when I was a kid in Canada and I collected hockey cards, and I had a Gretzky rookie, which was the most expensive, supposedly, hockey card you could get just about back then. At one time, they were saying it was worth about $800. But then I figured out at some point it's only worth $800 if you can actually get somebody to pay the $800. With Neymar, what they're betting on is a huge benefit to the brand, to Paris Saint-Germain. The deputy managing director last week said, you know, look, we've merged two brands. We've merged the PSG brand and we've merged the Neymar brand. PSG's got about 200 million fans around the world. Neymar has 30 million Twitter followers, 60 million on Facebook, and 78 million on Instagram. So what they're hoping to do, of course, everybody's trying to go into places like Europe and North America in terms of their marketing. So they're hoping that he will bring all kinds of new followers, be the new face of the club internationally, and raise the value of the club over the next few years.
There have been all sorts of estimates and speculation about how much this deal really costs. And basically, we don't really know because none of us have seen these contracts. But are we really talking 700 to 800 million euros over 5 years?
It seems that way. This is different from other transfers. We actually know what the fee was because it was a release clause. It was 222 million euros from Barcelona. Then you get the VAT that PSG's got to pay on that. So apparently that takes it up in total to 268. He's got a salary of 30 million a year, we think. We don't know for sure. Apparently they got to pay a huge tax on that salary. So what I've seen gets us up to about 718 million if you take that salary also over 5 years. And then a bonus for his father. There was also a signing bonus apparently for him of 78 million. So it looks like that's about the ballpark.
The deal has started huge discussions in the footballing world and beyond. But how on earth can PSG say that that amount of money meets the FIFA fair play rules?
Well, FIFA fair play is interesting. To try to explain it as simply as I can, teams are, or clubs are assessed over a three-year period. We're currently in the period between 2015-16 and 2017-18, the upcoming season. Clubs are allowed to spend up to 5 million more per season than they take in. However, they can also get around this by up to 30 million euros by an investor or the owner or whatever paying that off and getting them back to zero. So there are ways to get around this. And it seems to be full of holes, to be honest. And I was thinking about how did they get around it? Because when they held the press conference to unveil Neymar, the president, Nasser Al-Khelaifi, said, don't worry about it. It's all above board. Financial fair play is not a problem. And then poking around, I found that these 222 million they can amortize over the 5 years of his contract, which takes you per season down to 44.4 million euros. Still a huge amount, but much more manageable, let's say, than 222. You know, they're betting on the fact that they're just going to sell him a huge number of jerseys, for one thing. Apparently, after the deal went through, I mean, last Friday, you saw the pictures. I wasn't there, but people were lined up, it seemed, for blocks outside of the PSG store at the Parc des Princes just to buy the newly minted Paris Saint-Germain jerseys with Neymar Jr. on the back. Apparently, they sold like 10,000 of them. And the sales just keep going on. And I think they're up to 140 euros per jersey. So,
has this set a dangerous precedent, do you think?
It's what the market will bear, I guess, but there's definitely a lot of concern about it. Bayern Munich chairman Karl-Heinz Rummenigge has come out really critical about it. He was asked about it, I guess, a few hours ago, and he said, you know, if I were looking at this, I'd be thinking about, do I want a stadium or do I want a player? Because they built their Allianz Arena several years ago, and I think they took a mortgage out for somewhere north of 350 million euros, not that far off what they're paying for Neymar. The president of PSG said when he was unveiled that he thinks it's a good deal because he thinks within 2 years, Neymar's value will be double at least.
That was Chuck Penfold from Deutsche Welle's Sports Desk talking to my colleague Emma Wallis. From the football field to the boxing ring, he has been described as a young man fighting fascism. Italy's boxing champion Leone Giocavocci was born of a Congolese mother and an Italian father, but fought his way to becoming one of the best boxers in the 1920s. But Giocavocci has largely been forgotten until now, thanks to a recent film called The Duce's Boxer. Mauro Valeri, who contributed to the film, also wrote the book that inspired it, Black Roman. Reporter Christopher Livesey has been talking to him to find out more.
Ecco casa. Prego.
I've come to Rome to meet sociology professor and writer Mauro Valeri. c'è un artista in casa.
Sì, mia moglie.
Professor Valeri has written several books and many articles about racism in sport and became fascinated with the story of Leone Iacovacci, a mixed-race boxer who defied the odds and became a huge name in an increasingly fascist 1920s Italy.
When he went to train before a fight, people paid to see him. When he arrived in the train station, there were hundreds of people waiting to see him. He was really an idol. A lot of people said he could have gone for the world title.
Valeri says that although Iacovacci was such a huge figure at the time, his contributions to history have been effectively buried. And if it wasn't for some of Valeri's own experiences of racism, they may have stayed that way.
16 years ago, I wasn't there. My wife and son were on a bus. My wife is of Ethiopian origin, so she's rather dark. My son was 5, he's mixed race. He touched this man, and the man pushed him on the floor of the bus and told him, "Negroes, get out of Italy. Long live Il Duce." The problem came a week later when my 5-year-old son said, "Dad, I want to become white." I was already studying racism, but I felt disorientated. So in that moment, I thought the right thing to do was to find some black Italian role models that my son and other kids could identify with. For me, Iacovacci kind of represents this as well. It's not just the story of a black Italian, but it's a story devoted to all black Italian kids who are still considered even today as foreigners, as people who don't have a history in Italy. This is the added meaning of the book I wrote.
Il significato reale del libro che ho scritto.
Iacovacci was born in 1902 to a Congolese mother and an Italian father.
Questo è la fotografia di quando è nato.
This is the photograph of when Leone was born in the Congo. This is the mother and this is the servant, because the mother was a princess, so she had a boy holding an umbrella for her and the baby. This is Leone when he's a bit bigger, but he's dressed as a little sailor. He looks almost as if he's in a boxing stance, you see?
Valeri says that Iacovacci was taken to Italy by his father in 1905, and after living with grandparents for several years, he was then sent to boarding school with his brother Aristide.
After their grandmother dies in 1911, they go to this school in Frascati, but he's constantly running away. Then, when he's 14, he graduates from elementary school and leaves Italy entirely. He goes to Taranto in Puglia and asks to work aboard an English merchant ship. The story goes that he introduces himself not as an Italian child, but a child from Calcutta. He was absolutely different. There were few black Italians, so it wasn't a positive story. There were a lot of prejudices about black people, so he surely felt out of place in Italy.
Non adeguato in Italia. E l'hanno preso in questa nave lui per
They take him aboard. For 2 years he works as a cabin boy. Then in 1918 he arrives in England and completely changes his identity. He's no longer called Leone Iacovacci, but John Douglas Walker, and he claims he was born in 1900. He does this in order to enlist.
Perché così può arruolarsi.
Valeri says that Iacovacci, now known as Walker and pretending to be English, joined the 53rd Battalion, Bedfordshire Regiment, of the British Army and was sent to fight in Russia.
And this regiment, it's funny because he's the only black man here too. It wasn't so easy to find other black men. We don't know anything about how he carried himself in battle. There's no distinction in the documents we have. I think there's something, but the kind of distinction they give to every soldier. Nothing particularly, there's no medals. But he certainly fought with dignity.
After the war, Iacovacci returned to England, still posing as John Douglas Walker.
He recalls that while he was walking one day along the Thames, he's approached by a boxing organiser who asks if he wants to fight because he needs a black man. Back then, it was very popular to put a black against a white fighter to show who was stronger, the black man's brute force or the white man's intelligence. And since the black man had run away with the money, so they say this organiser sees a black man along the Thames, asks if he wants to fight. He says, "I've never boxed before, but no, come, you'll make £5. And it seems he opted to fight for the money. Not only does he win the match, but the whole tournament.
In non solo vince l'incontro, ma vince tutto il torneo.
At that time in England, black boxers weren't allowed to compete for their country. And Valeri says this prompted another change of identity for Iacovacci, that of an African-American called Jack Walker. This allowed him to move to France, where many African-American boxers were making a good living.
Lui viene chiamato a combattere nel 1922. Viene chiamato.
He's called to fight in 1922 in Italy against one of the best Italian fighters, Frattini, and comes as Jack Walker, the African-American, against the Italian Frattini. During a round, I think the 10th or 11th, he asks for some water, but the assistant doesn't hear him. He's distracted. Then the assistant hears this shout, "Gimme water!"
Dicevo, dammi l'acqua.
And everyone says, "Who is that speaking Roman?" Then he lets the cat out of the bag. "I'm not Jack Walker. My real name is Leone Iacovacci, and I'm Italian."
Leone Iacovacci, sono italiano.
For the next few years, Iacovacci won just about every match, becoming both the Italian and European middleweight champion. But with the rise of fascism under Mussolini, his position was precarious, and the government wanted to ensure that he was knocked off his pedestal by white Italian champion Mario Bosisio at Rome's National Stadium.
Il fascismo, secondo me, convinto che vincesse Bosisio.
The fascist government, in my opinion, because it thinks Bosisio is going to win, invests a lot in the event. It renovates the stadium, publicizes it, it becomes the first sporting match broadcast on the radio. So all Italians are listening. They wanted to film it and show it in all the Italian cinemas to show for the first time two Italians fighting for the European title. This match is very important. The fascist top brass want ringside seats. But then the unexpected happens. Iacovacci wins outright, uncontested. But that victory was the beginning of the end of his career. 2 days later, a story comes out on the front page of Gazzetta dello Sport by Cotrone, one of the biggest sports writers, saying a black man can't represent Italy.
Di fatto, cioè, non può essere un nero a rappresentare l'Italia.
Professor Valeri says that Iacovacci eventually moved back to France, but returned to Italy after the Second World War. He died in Milan in 1983 at the age of 81. Given that his story has been effectively buried until now, I wondered how Valeri had gathered so much information.
La mia fortuna, soprattutto su Iacovacci, è stata che...
My stroke of luck was when I found his daughter, his only daughter, who was born in 1944. She lives in a far-flung village in northern Italy. I tracked her down, I visited her, and I told her about my interest in her father. She's a very close, shy person. And after I'd been talking for half an hour, she seemed very cold, and then says to me, "Wait one moment." She goes into the basement. She comes back with a very big box in her hands and says, "This is everything I have of my father's." And inside, there was practically the whole history of Iacovacci.
Without those records, Valeri's book and the new film by Tony Sacucci might never have seen the light of day, because although that historic Iacovacci-Bosisio match was filmed, there's a crucial part that's missing.
Ha tagliato la vittoria di Iacovacci.
They cut the victory of Iacovacci, so it doesn't exist. The film exists up until the 15th round, then there's nothing. The paradox is that, as per contract, the film is shown all over Italian cinemas. But they ask Bosisio to do the commentary and not Iacovacci. Bosisio, along with his mother, gets to comment about the fight and says that he won, not Iacovacci. Even the radio coverage, we did research into it, both me and the director, and the radio coverage has disappeared. At some point, fascism decided that this story must not be told.
The Duce's Boxer premiered recently in 25 Italian cities to mark the UN International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. With the rise of neo-fascism in Europe, it seems that the story of Leone Iacovacci is as relevant now as it was nearly a century ago. This is Christopher Livesay for DW in Rome, Italy.
We hope you have enjoyed the show, and we would love to hear your response in an email via feedback.africa@dw.com. You can also find us on Facebook, DW Africa. We will be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. I'm Zipporah Nyambura. From all of us here at Deutsche Welle, have a wonderful week ahead.